Crystal here. I'm a math teacher in New York City. Welcome to School of Practice on Edutopia Radio.
Imagine a third grade classroom where some learners are reading at grade level, but others are closer to a kindergarten level.
Ovals in the park.
And a few are ready for fifth grade material.
Other tribes of the Great Plains, there was no.
As a teacher, differentiating to help all the kids in your classroom learn can feel overwhelming, but it's something every teacher needs to get good at from pre-K through 12th grade.
So when an administrator says to me like, hey, Michael, you need to differentiate, the first thing in my mind I'm thinking is, how do I do that for 180 students in my total student load as a secondary teacher? How do I level tasks for every single student?
That's Michael McDowell. He's an author and a former teacher and admin based in California. And he says the solution teachers often opt for is simply breaking kids into smaller groups.
We think of differentiation as like, how do I separate students? They have all of these diverse needs, and the best way to support them is to put them into different spots.
But what if good differentiation, at least a lot of the time, isn't about separation? I'm Kristen Leong, an editor at Edutopia, and I'm also a former middle school teacher. Today, Michael is here to share a more effective approach that makes learning accessible for all students in a full group.
I don't think we have to actually move kids away from teachers as much as we typically do. When students are with teachers, we see the greatest impact. So as soon as we say, go work in small groups, go work individually, I think the impact is less.
Now, you may be thinking, wait, there is good research supporting small group work for differentiation. We'll get into that with Michael. And he'll share three low-prep differentiation strategies that keep kids together and maintain rigor. Okay, let's get into it. Michael, why is differentiation so hard for teachers?
I think that we think of differentiation as every student is so unique. How can I support 32 students and all of those different needs that students have? And I think we have to shift that to, where are the similarities that we can tap into for all of the students? And then what are small little shifts we can do when they're with us during that gradual release of responsibility where I can target some specific needs that some students have, but they're with us. We're not tutoring, we're teaching.
So you're shifting your framing from differences to similarities. That's interesting. We're going to dig into that a little bit more later. But now for this next question, I would love your perspective both as a teacher when you're still in the classroom and also as a coach and a mentor teacher. Are there common mistakes with differentiation that you see in classrooms that you visit or that you made while you were teaching?
I definitely have made a lot of errors in terms of my teaching. We often move quickly through the gradual release of responsibility. And we kind of get to like, all right, I'm going to kind of present the tasks and the things that we're going to do. And then you're going to go and work. And I think the magic where the highest impact is in that guided practice, in that we do work. In fact, often when I'm coaching, I'm like, we need to default to that we do, because when we're together, so when teachers and students are together, actually working together in that space, I actually think you're meeting specific individual needs, specific questions that students have. And part of this for me is that I don't think of rigor as vertical, as a hierarchy. I think of rigor as a taxonomy. Do I know it? Can I relate it? And can I apply it? Students are going to be all over the place around those three. But if I teach across those three, I'm going to bring more and more of my students into that space with me. And that, to me, is the key to differentiation.
So again, more time in the we do guided practice phase, and then this idea of rigor as a taxonomy. I really like that, Michael. Now, you mentioned small shifts that can make learning accessible for all students in a full group. This feels like a really important detail for differentiation. What are we talking about here?
There's kind of a general approach that I think we can take. Who are the students that are below, at, and above the instruction? And so for me, if a student is below, there's going to be more specific corrective feedback that I'm going to be giving that student. And there might be specific questions I ask that student versus someone that might be right at grade level. So at an advanced level, I might give them a what if. I might say, well, what if we change this variable? Whereas the student that is right at standard, I might ask, well, why? Why do you think that might be? And a student who's struggling, I might say, so this is the right answer. This is the incorrect answer. But I want you to walk me through why I just told you that. I can differentiate, but still keep the students together. And they don't really recognize that I'm pivoting and just changing a little bit of my questions.
Now, one thing that is still unclear for me is the small group piece. There is research showing that small group work can have big benefits for students, and that's especially true for high-performing students and kids with learning disabilities. But are you saying that it is still better to avoid separating kids at all?
So to me, I look at it as like, if you're going to put students in groups, how do we know that they're going to be managed well? How do you know that they're going to have effective conversations if you're not there with them? Small group work should be short and sharp with a high level of support and accountability.
So how do you know when you need to move to small groups?
The small group instruction is moving them to more independent level work, and that I, as a teacher, can recognize whether students are clear on the steps. So I might say, okay, I think they're all kind of struggling with step one. Let's just work on this part of step one. So I'm going to have everybody work. You're going to have 47 seconds to work on this together in small groups. Everyone, you know, huddle around, have that conversation. And then I'm going to say, group one, what do you have? Group two, what do you have? That gives me a sense of, do I send them back out to do a little bit more work? I think we have to get out of the mindset of the first third is I do, the second third is we do, the last third is you do. To me, it's you got a little bit and then we're going to come back. You got a little bit, we're going to come back. So it's very proactive. It's just very active.
Okay. So I'm hearing you say that small group work is proactive and it's really a tool that you're using throughout the lesson, like a quick focused check for understanding. You're in and then you're out. Now, differentiating with the whole class together sounds more challenging to pull off. Is it? Or is it one of those things where once you get the hang of it, it's actually a time saver and more effective?
Yeah, I think it's a huge time saver. I mean, I'm not spending all this time outside of this being like, how do I do different things for different students? I think it's actually less overwhelming than this idea of separating everything.
After the break, we'll walk through Michael's whole class differentiation strategies. He'll tell us how they work across grade levels and subjects, and why a little cold calling can help boost engagement in these kinds of group discussions. Okay. Be right back.
Hi, it's Paige from the Edutopia team. As an editor covering tech in the classroom, I hear from educators every day who are excited by everything it can unlock in their teaching. Others are overwhelmed by all the tools. That's why we created the Wired Classroom, our free monthly newsletter packed with real strategies from real teachers using tech to boost student engagement and deepen learning. Subscribe now at edutopia.org/thewiredclassroom.
Okay, let's get into the specifics of your strategies and talk about how they work in class, starting with what you call protocols that differentiate through similarities.
To me, it's creating activities like what I would use is like a modified FAIR model where the students might come into class and I'm going to ask students to, hey, pick one of these questions that I might have where one question's at that surface level, one's at deep, one's at that transfer level, and say, pick the one you want to go after. And I want to hear that as a class to see where are my students across these types of learning. And so what I'm doing is I'm still giving them some activities that are a little bit different, but we're doing it together. And it only requires one slide from me, which is really nice from a planning standpoint.
You know, we hear about the FAIR model in a few of our interviews, actually, for the show. This, of course, is the simple graphic organizer. Kids add a definition for a vocab word or a math concept. Then they write in examples, non-examples, and they can even draw a visual. Why is this such an effective tool for differentiation?
Well, I think the FAIR model that I'm offering up is a little bit different in terms of the level of complexity of the question. So what we're not doing is saying, here's the same question four different ways. What we're doing is we're saying, here's a question, but you need to attack that question by either defining or solving, relating or applying. It's reinforcing some of that procedural level understanding or surface level understanding if you're high achieving. And if you're low achieving in this particular moment, you're getting access to some of that high achieving response.
And I know that hearing that high level response from peers must be very impactful. And then to have teacher there rephrasing or underscoring, that's much more impactful than say a teacher saying, and here's how these four questions relate to each other.
Yes. I think, again, it has to go back to classroom discussion. That's the function of this work.
Okay. Here's another one that uses a slide with a four square grid. Tell me about same surface, different depth problems. This looks like the FAIR model you just described, but it also reminds me of low floor, high ceiling tasks. What's the idea here?
I think that it allows me to make sure that every student can attack a different problem. And then as a class, we can talk about how do all four of these connect. So let's just say we had a problem around central tendency and one student went and looked at mean and another group looked at median, another group looked at average. And then we said, okay, so we just looked at all of those three problems. How do they connect? And then as we're going through, they're hearing all the other groups and there's a reinforcement around central tendency. It teaches transfer, it goes back and it reinforces deep. And it allows all students to have access to that, and I can keep them together.
Okay. So we have talked about two low prep scaffolds that are great for differentiating instruction, Frayer models and same surface, different depth problems. Now, what happens if you have a few students who seem confused or disengaged when you're using these strategies? What's your advice to teachers for supporting kids without interrupting the whole class lesson?
If I have a couple of students that are struggling, and I'm still with the whole class, I might do a quick clarity check with the whole class. So really quickly, I might just say, everybody stop for a second. What are we learning to do and what are we learning it through? And I wanna see if those three or four students meet that clarity check right there. And then I'm gonna probably weave in a couple of questions about the core content. I might say, you've got 30 seconds to a quick turn and talk. I'm gonna go right over and listen to those two students to see what they have. I'm gonna do those types of checks. So when I pull that small group later, I have a better sense of clarity, content, skill.
Let's move on to your next strategy. And you use basketball to differentiate classroom questions and help kids move from surface level questions to deeper inquiry. How does this work in class?
This is probably my biggest fundamental error when I was teaching is I played ping pong. So I would ask a question. I'd have three students immediately like boom, they put their hand up and they would answer. And then I would explain why their answers were so great. And 27 other students were like, we're done. And I was like,
I'm off the hook.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, we crushed it. And then I would get the assessments back and I'd be like, what happened to the kids? And part of that is because I felt like I was struggling for speed, like I needed to go faster.
Michael, I cannot imagine you ever struggling with speed. Just side note.
Well, I mean, I felt that way because I was like, I got a billion standards that we have to cover, right? Like, but yes, I know I speak a little quickly. But what I learned when I started to shift to basketball questioning, which is essentially kind of from that old like Hoosiers movie where it's like, I'm going to pass the ball at least five times before we shoot the ball. It was kind of this classic like rule they had to play in this movie. And what I started to do is to start to say, look, I'm not going to say anything until at least five people have gone to a particular question and then it will come back to me. And what I found is that I actually saved a lot of time. I wasn't explaining as much and it was actually a lot faster.
In this basketball activity, are you cold calling kids?
Yes.
Ah, that's good clarifying. So you're keeping kids on their toes by cold calling. And I know some teachers aren't into cold calling. What's your take?
Here's what I would say. So when you're doing direct modeling, my suggestion would be cold call, but the only cold call questions you're gonna ask them are what we call process questions. So you might say, what was the difference between step one and step two?
Okay, so when we're playing basketball with students, we're gonna do some cold calling, pass that question to five different kids approximately before moving on. But those cold call questions are just to ensure that kids are right there with you in terms of the process and that they're clear on expectations for the lesson.
Yeah. When we get to the we do, I am going to start cold calling them on content-based questions. But again, I think the way that I do that is if I know where my students are, I'm going to start asking different types of questions. So I might ask one student, can you solve this? I might ask another student, like, why did I use a tape diagram in this particular situation? So that student who I know has maybe a higher level of proficiency, like I know that they can do the procedures, I'm going to ask them that more difficult question. But that student that just did the lower level type of question heard the answer to that question. Be like, oh, so they're actually getting reinforcement. So I'm cold calling, but the cold calls are where students are. It's not a gotcha. It's
like, you know, the kids.
Yeah. And if a student doesn't, if I ask the wrong question, great learning for me. And I'll even say to the student as they're working about it, like, you know what? I might even say, I think that was the wrong question. Let me give you a different one. Or I might say, you know what? That question takes like a little bit of processing time. Let's just turn to each other. Let's just talk for 10, 15 seconds. Everyone do it. This is a really important question. Because usually they just need another 10 seconds. And they're like, no, I got it. It's just you kind of called me on that and I needed a minute. Like that to me is where cold calling is so powerful.
Okay, let's use a history class as an example. Walk Great. Me through how a teacher would guide students through a series of questions in this basketball experience from surface level to deeper and then to transfer.
So let's just say we've just done some direct modeling. I'm going into that we do space. And I'm like, let's just make sure we know when we say the word imperialism, what do we mean? Like, what is the definition of imperialism? And I'm just going to cold call someone. That's surface. Another student, I might say, when we say colonialism and imperialism, what are there differences? How are they similar? How are they different? Everyone do about 10 seconds of process time, but I'm going to ask you to actually share out what your thoughts are, or I might have you paraphrase what your partner just shared, because I think that's really important. That's deep.
Okay, so we have the surface level, yeah. We have the deeper, then what's the transfer question in this example?
So then another example I might say to a student is like, so give me two situations where we might say this level of imperialistic tendency in the world today. And they might say, well, looking at this particular military and what they're trying to do to occupy these particular lands, like that looks like a classic example of imperialism. Like, I'd be like, great, can you think of another situation? So because transfer is about breadth, it's not about depth. Now, again, here's the key. These are not hierarchical levels. So a student who is struggling in my class still gets transfer level questions.
Okay, this is the perfect segue to your third and final strategy.
Okay.
We know that transfer level knowledge and skills are critical for applying learning across discipline and contexts. How should teachers think about creating universally accessible transfer questions for class discussions?
You start with showing kids multiple contexts and saying, how are these similar and different? A little spot the difference, like those old highlight magazines where we like look at the little cartoons and be like, oh, this leaf is turned here and this leaf is here. That is the key. And then the questions we ask are things like, how do these two situations relate?
I mean, what I'm hearing from you is that at the core of universally accessible transfer questions are critical thinking and real world application, which we should be inviting all students to participate in that kind of thinking, regardless of what academic level they seem to be testing on.
Yes.
Does the concept of universally accessible change depending on what level you teach, elementary, middle, or high school?
No, I think it's the same. I think 4 and 5 year olds are exceptional at transfer. I think when they learn skills, they see, oh, that skill applies in all these different things in my life. It's almost like you don't have any blinders on. And then I think as you learn math, you put on a blinder. In English, you put on a blinder. In social studies, you put on a blinder. And you need to do that to go deep into a core academic area. Like, this is what we mean by these types of ideas. So the one thing I would shift is we need to do a lot more transfer level activities in high school because we don't see a lot of that. And the kids are getting these blinders like, what do I need to do so I can just get on with my life in this math class?
Now, I want to ask you about something that a lot of teachers, especially in the early years, struggle with. When I was a first year middle school ELA teacher, I had students reading around a third grade level, and I also had kids reading at a far advanced high school level. I hear you about the benefits of differentiating in ways that don't separate students, but what about reading? Given all the reading levels you'll have in one classroom, what's your advice for good differentiation?
The first thing I would do is to say, I want to find out for my students how much background knowledge they have to access the reading. That would be one. So for me, it's like, give them enough direct modeling around that. And then two, the second thing I would do is to say, let's do some of this reading together. And then I might say, okay, we're going to do some independent reading. And in that independent reading, I may then start to separate some of those texts. But for me, I'm always thinking about how much background knowledge do students bring into this despite just the skills of reading. And that goes back to similarities. Do the kids have the facts? Let's go find that out first as a class before I start saying, well, they're in the third grade reading level. So they got another text and they're going to go on a separate journey than the rest of my class. Like, no. We're going to go on the same journey.
So we're going to use the same book for all students to start. We're going to lean into background knowledge building and collective knowledge before we release kids to read independently.
Yes.
And only after we've done that work together do we start differentiating the text for different reading levels. Now, Michael, I have one last question. When your approach to whole group differentiation is working, what does that look like?
Well, we know it's working because we see every single student that is engaging in some level of cognitive engagement. There's a high level of discourse. Students are sharing ideas. That to me is where we see success.
Here are three things I'm taking away from this conversation. One, in classrooms across grade levels, kids' skills, academic achievement, and background knowledge can vary widely, but good differentiation doesn't necessarily mean splitting students up. Instead, Michael says, look for ways to design learning that starts with similarities, not differences. Think of it as one task with many doors in. Two, group discourse is key to Michael's approach. Whether you're playing basketball with surface, deep, and transfer questions, or talking through different problems and solutions from a same surface, different deep slide, it's important for kids to take part in high-quality group discussions that are carefully facilitated by teachers. And three, there will always be a need for small group work. To make it super productive, Michael suggests keeping it brief and focused with a high level of support and accountability. That ensures that all students are going on the same learning journey together. Special thanks to Michael McDowell. He taught high school math and science for 5 years before moving on to admin roles for more than a decade. Now, he's an author and consultant working with schools around the world. We'll link to his Edutopia article about differentiating without separation in our episode notes. If you liked this episode, follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave us a rating and a review. This helps others find our show. This episode was produced by Anne Noisani and edited by me. Our engineer is Doug Keeley, and our supervising editors are Sarah Gonser and Steve Merrill. Special thanks to Yuki Terada, Declan, and Raphael. I'm Kristen Leong. We'll see you again soon.